We are holding on page 132 in Sanhedrin, the second line of the wide lines, middle of Ois Kuf Mem Vav. We started learning yesterday that when Rus left the granary after the night that she had spent there, she had gone to sleep by Boaz's feet and that she talked with him, etc. So the Pasuk says that he gave her Sheish Sa'odim, and we started talking about that that means that he gave her a decent amount of grain for herself and Nami to eat, but in addition, he also gave her six grains or six stalks of barley, and that was symbolic of that she's going to have six descendants, each of whom have six special qualities. So the six, we said, were David, Mashiach, Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. So David, we went through yesterday that that when Doeg first mentions, when Doeg, Hadoimi, first mentions David to Shaul, he mentions six qualities that he has, and we explain what the meaning is of the phrases they use in the Pasuk. Next, Mashiach. Where do we see that Mashiach has six special qualities? The Pasuk says, V'nachal of Ruach Hashem, the spirit of Hashem will rest on him. Ruach Chochma Uvina, a spirit of Chochma and Bina, of wisdom and understanding. Ruach Eitzo Gvoro, a spirit of advice and strength. Ruach Das, V'yiras Hashem V'gomer, and a spirit of knowledge and fear of Hashem. So we see, in other words, that we have six qualities mentioned over there. Chochma, Bina, Eitzo Gvoro, Das, and Yiras Hashem. So those are the six qualities of Mashiach, which we're saying he's another one of these six. In other words, Ruach Hashem is a general thing, and then the six, and then specifically within that is going to be six things. Interesting thing, by the way, the Rebbe points out, you know, we in the Ribbono Shel Olam that we say when the Sefer Torah is taken out on Yom Tovim, we say over there at Tefillah, where we mention the Skaim Bonam Mikra Shekosov, there should be filled in us what it says, and we quote this Pasuk. So what does it mean? We're not Mashiach. These are the qualities of Mashiach, it's saying over here. So this points up the idea that every Yid has within him a nitzah, it's a spark of Mashiach. He has his own personal Mashiach within him, his Yechidah ben Nefesh, and we're asking Hashem that that should be able to be revealed by us the way it's going to be revealed for the whole world on the national level and on the world level by Mashiach. Okay. Uchtiv. Now another pasuk says about Mashiach. Some of Horsham take out the word uchtiv, because now the Gemara is saying a separate thing. The pasuk continues after it mentions these six qualities of Mashiach. It continues v'harichoy b'yiras Hashem. It says v'harichoy with fear of Hashem. We're going to explain what two meanings of v'harichoy. V'loy l'mare einav yishbot. He won't have to judge by what he sees with his eyes. V'loy l'mishma oznav yichiyach, and he won't have to rebuke and give toichacha to people based on what he hears with his ears. In other words, he's going to have a higher level of perception. So what's this v'harichoy? Amar Alexandri, Melamachet in a mitzvah svi surim kerichayim, means that Hashem loads down Mashiach with mitzvahs and with suffering like millstones. So v'harichoy meloshen rechayim, meloshen millstones. So he has lots of mitzvahs. That's what gives him the schus to be the Mashiach, and he's loaded down with yisurim that he takes on himself the averus of the Jewish people. Later on in the Perek, we're going to have a long, here we're just mentioning Mashiach briefly. Later in the Perek, we're going to have, Be'ez Hashem, a long sugya about Mashiach. Maybe this should help. By the time we reach that point, we can actually be learning it with Mashiach. But anyway, so you have a long sugya later on Daf Tzadik Ches, Tzadik Tes, in the Masechta, that talks about Mashiach. And there it talks about how he suffers the pains and the yisurim that many of us ought to because of our averus. So now, therefore, this is compared, Marshall points out, to millstones. You put in a lot of effort into using millstones, but afterwards then you have ground grain. You have flour from it that you make bread and you eat from it. The same way the Jewish people will be zeicha to geula through the fact that Mashiach is loaded down with mitzvahs and with yisurim. So that's one meaning of v'harichoy meloshen rechayim. Rava Amar, Rava says a different explanation of v'harichoy, demodach v'doyin. It means that he will smell. So the word v'doyin actually has two possible ways that you could punctuate it, two different nekudas that you can put on it. It can mean modach v'doyin, meaning that he will smell with certainty. He'll be able to sniff out the certainty of who's good and who's not, who's right and who's wrong in judgment, etc. It can also mean modach v'doyin, he will smell, and based on that, he will judge. So in other words, he will be able to judge by his sense of smell. Dichtiv, as the pasuk says, lo lamada ein av yishpot, as the pasuk says, he won't have to judge by the sight of his eyes, the shofet patzedek dalim, and yet he's going to be judging the poor with righteousness, v'rechiach b'mishra la'an ve'aretz, and he'll give teuchacha in the proper straight way to the humble of the earth. So we see, in other words, he's not going to have to rely on his eyes and ears, he's going to be able to rely on his sense of smell. That's how Rashi explains it. In other words, the chiddush is, even though he's not going to have to use his eyes and his ears, to, as most dayanim do, nevertheless, he's going to be judging righteously. Marsha says it's actually kind of the other way around. You know, here you have the expression, ein l'dayan ala masha ein avroyas. The dayan has to go based on what he sees with his eyes. He can't take into consideration factors that he doesn't know about. But after all, said and done, you know, he could be misled or something. He could see something and not understand what not realize what he saw. He perceives it wrongly. Or he hears with his ears and Baalei Din and the Edim and whatever might be putting forward false claims. So he can only go according to the MS that comes in front of him. Okay, you know, in various places in Shas it mentions that a dayan has to judge Din MS La'amitoi, where one of the meanings of that Tosfos explains is, if he realizes it's a din meruma, if he realizes that there's something fishy over here, then he has to investigate further. But what if he doesn't? You know, the fact is, what if they really cover their tracks very well? Then there's nothing he can do about it. Mashiach is going to go beyond that. He's going to be able to use a sense of smell for that. And the sense of smell, Maharsha points out, is the most ruchniistic of all our senses. So it's the least susceptible to going wrong. In fact, Bnei Yisrael points out an interesting thing in that connection, it's the only one of the senses that was not affected by the Chet Tadas. The sense of taste, the sense of sight, of hearing, of touch, were all affected, though those were all involved in the Chatei Tadas. Smell was not, and therefore even now, smell is a more ruchniistic sense, and now we're saying Mashiach will have that heightened perception of smell that the rest of us, for us, smell is our most ruchniistic of our senses, but Mashiach will have an even higher level of that comparable to what was before the Chatei Tadas. In fact, it's also brought in that connection. This is one reason we smell the samim Matzah Shabbos, the Shibboleth Aleket brings, and it's brought from there in the postgame. We smell the samim Matzah Shabbos, and we know the idea is because the Neshama Yisera is leaving, and it makes a person feel bad, and therefore we have spices in order to make it feel better. Again, the idea being that the spices go to the Neshama, but it's also related to the idea. The same way, for example, it says the Etzem Luz didn't benefit from the Chatei Tzedas, the only part of the body that didn't get anything from the Chatei Tzedas, because it only gets from the food of Malava Malka. Therefore, there's an Inyan, that's why there's a particular Indian to have a Malava Malka on Matzah Shabbos in order to feed the Etzem Luz. In the same way, on Matzah Shabbos is also there's you have a particular thing to smell the Samim in order to be using the sense of smell, which is the only one that was not affected by the Chatei Tadas. As far as what we're saying that he's going to judge by smell, there's a number of different Mephoshim talk about him, and look, you have rules of evidence in the Torah. How can he judge by that? So, and there's a few different answers. One of them is he's going to judge by his sense of smell. Again, you know, similar to what Maharsha is saying, that you can have false edim, you can have false Baalei Din, you can have all kinds of things like that, where they can trick a dayan. He's going to be able to cut through and see all of those, and see what's honest and what's not with all of that. So as far as the actual psak din, of course, he has to use, you know, he has to refer to the Gemara and the poskim and all, but in terms of cutting through, if anybody's trying to deceive him or whatever, he'll be able to see through, he'll be able to smell through that. Related to that is also the idea, for example, we talk about Tishvi Yataritz Koshis V'Yiboyis, that Eliyahu is going to come and answer all the Sfeikas. And the question is, what happened to Torah Lo B'Shamayim? And one answer is that Mashiach, that Eliyahu, rather, as far as Eliyahu, is it's not that he's going to tell us in these cases what the din is, but he can tell us what the facts are. When you have a question on the facts, is this thing, what was the story with this thing? Did it belong to Pliny or did it belong to Pliny? He'll be able to ferret out the facts. So now we're saying Mashiach will be able to use his sense of smell in the same way to know the facts, and then based on that, the psak din can be given out according to the usual rules of halacha. The Rogachover makes another point about it as well. The Rogachover points out Mashiach, among the many roles that Mashiach is going to play, he's going to be a melech. And a melech, we know, has the right to judge not according to the regular rules of evidence anyway. As it is, for example, the Sanhedrin or any Beis Din needs two Edim and they need Hasra and they need the whole nine yards. A melech doesn't need any of that. So therefore, Mashiach, and by virtue of the fact that he's a melech, he'll be able to use irregular methods, such as in this case, his sense of smell, to be able to judge and to be able to decide accordingly, and to be able to judge what should be done to people accordingly. So the Gemara tells in this connection, Bar Kuziva Molach Tauten Shninu Pauga. Bar Kuziva, this is in general history, is better known as Bar Kochva. They found letters of him. They found fragments of letters of him of his in the dead among the Dead Sea Scrolls and things like that. Turns out apparently his original name was Shimon Bar Kusva, where Kusva is maybe the name of the town he came from, or maybe it's his father's name or whatever. And then so later on they called him for a period of time Bar Kochva, because as we're going to talk about, many of the Chachamim, including Rabbi Akiva, thought that he was Mashiach, and then Rabbi Akiva said on the pasuk Dorach Kochav Miyakov, a star steps forth from Yaakov, and therefore they called him Bar Kochva. Later on, when the whole thing collapsed, and as the Gemara is going to say, it turned out he wasn't Mashiach after all. So one explanation is they called him Bar Kuziva as Meloshin Kozav, like it turned out to be a lie and a falsehood. Anyway, Moloch Taut and Shninu Pauga, he ruled for 2.5 years. The whole uprising that he, now interestingly, who was he? Rashi identifies that he was Malchi Hudus, that he was actually from the kings of the family of Hudus. The family of Hudus basically ruled over Eretz Yisrael until the Churban. Some of them ruled in areas near Eretz Yisrael for a decade or two after that. So maybe Rashi means that he's ultimately descended from them, or what Rashi means by that is a little hard to say, because again, they were not really ruling by the time he came forward in history, which is about 50 or 60 years after the Churban. In any case, when we say that he ruled for 2.5 years, one man in particular, the Sefer Doros HaRishonim, on Jewish history explains that was the period, the whole revolt from beginning to end was a lot longer than 2.5 years, but we're focusing on the time when he actually captured Yerushalayim and ruled in it. They actually have coins that have been found from that time where he struck, that had pictures of the front of the Beis HaMikdash and had pictures of Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash and so forth, and they had written on it L'Cheirus Yisrael and Shimon Nisi Yisrael and other such expressions like that, and these are all from that period of his revolt. And so there was a period for a couple of years over there where he actually ruled in Yerushalayim, and that's what the Gemara is talking about over here. So Omer Lehu Rabbanan Ano Mashiach. So he says to the Chachamim of his times, I'm Mashiach. Omrulay said, and in fact, we find that Rabbi Akiva believes in him. That Amman points out that Rabbi Akiva was one of was from one Noisa Caleb. It was like one of his arms bearers. So he strongly supported that he indeed could be Mashiach. Although the Gemara says there were other Chachamim of that time, Rabbi Yechon ben Tursa in particular, would tell them nothing doing. This guy's not Mashiach. Anyway. So the Chacham said, "B'Mashiach Sib the Mordach V'Doyin." Well, by Mashiach it says that he's going to be able to smell and know for sure. He's going to be able to smell and judge. Nechsi Anani Mordach V'Doyin. Let's see if you have that capability. Kiven de Chazir de Le Mordach V'Doyin. They saw he didn't have that capability. Katluhu. So then they killed him. So now how are they kill him because he doesn't have Mordach V'Doyin? What's going on? So the Yad Ramah says because when he said that he's Mashiach and he's claiming that he has this power of Mordach V'Doyin amounted to saying that he's a Navi. And we know if a person claims that he's a Navi when he's not, then he's Chayiv Misa. So that would be one reason why they killed him. Other Mephoshim explained doesn't literally mean they killed him. It means the Chachamim stopped davening for him. Like this, they were davening for his success. And that was what was keeping the Romans at bay and keeping him more and more successful. Now, if they withdrew their support, then B'derech HaTeva is going to end up getting killed by the Romans. There's even an explanation that they judged him as being Chayiv Misa, but they didn't actually execute him, but eventually he was killed anyway.
So there's
a Gemara in Gittin that tells about a fellow named Bar Doroima who was killed by a snake, also a mighty warrior against the Romans, and he was eventually killed by the snake. From the Gemara over there, it seems that Bar Doroima is not necessarily identical with Bar Kuziva of our Gemara, so it could be the same thing happened twice to two different ones, or it could be that the story is told variantly about different people. The Medrash actually gives more details in particular it says then Bar Kuziva's uncle was Rabbi Lozer Hamudori, and Rabbi Lozer is constantly davening that the Romans should that Hashem should help Ben Kuziva. Bar Kuziva beat the Romans. And then to make a long story short, the Romans infiltrated a tzaduki in there to pretend like he's whispering something to Rabbi Lazar. And then when Bar Kochba asks him, what was that guy telling you? Then Rabbi Lazar says, I had no idea. He was just davening, he was learning or whatever. He didn't pay attention to whatever this guy's whispering in his ear. But Bar Kochba misjudged him and thought that he's actually in cahoots with the enemy and they're trading secrets. So he kicked Rabbi Lazar and killed him, and then a Baskel came in Hashemayim and said, you killed that great tzaddik, and therefore that's it. The Eibishter's protection is removed from you and you're a goner. So that's the story. So we see that Moruch V'Doyin is an essential thing for Mashiach. With that said, you know, it's interesting when the Rambam brings the criteria of what a person needs to be Cheskos Mashiach, Vade Mashiach, he doesn't bring this whole thing of Moruch V'Doyin. So evidently the Rambam holds that as much as the Gemara is saying over here, that's something important, it's not necessarily something that's an absolute prerequisite for someone to be Mashiach. As long as Osavi Tzliach, or Bonner Biknish Mikdash B'Mekoyma, etc., then he's Mashiach. So apparently if Bar Kochba had accomplished all of that, then the Chachamim might not have been worried so much about that he's not Moruch V'Doyin. Fine. So anyway, the point is, so that was a little bit of a digression, but the point is we see that Mashiach has these six qualities that are mentioned in the Pasuk. Next, Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, V'Azariah. We said they're the other four who are descended from Rus and Boaz, who each have four qualities. So what is that? Dichtiv v'hu. The Pasuk says about them. When Nebuchadnezzar, to begin, near the beginning of Sefer Daniel, it says that after Nebuchadnezzar had captured Jehoiakim and conquered Eretz Yisrael, so he ordered his chief of staff, a fellow named Ashpenaz, to bring. He tells him he wants Yolodim Asha'en Bahem Kolmum, young men in whom there's no defect, the Tovei Marev Gomer, and that they look good, they're handsome looking, and he goes on to mention a number of other qualities that they should have, the Maskilim B'chol Seichel, the Yoide Das and Vinei Mada. So he mentions six qualities that he wants in these young men that are going to be brought to his palace to be trained to be ministers for the king. So we see that Nebuchadnezzar himself wants people with these six qualities, and who did they find? So among them, from the Jews, there were Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, and the Gemara is understanding that it means that all of them are, in fact, from Shevet Yehuda and descended from the royal family. So therefore, they're all descended from Rus. What?
That's what they used to do. They used to take.
They would take in boys from the different subject nations. Not so much as collateral, although there is that as well, but more like this way they wanted to be able to use their talents and their brains to be able to help run the empire. It's a big multinational empire, and Nebuchadnezzar knows that, especially he knows Jewish brains, so. So we see that they had these six qualities because they were the ones who were chosen from among the Jews. So the Gemara says, let's analyze a couple of the things that it says about them. Most of them are fairly obvious. But first of all, my asher Abraham komum. What does it mean when the Pasuk says that there's no defect in them? One point of the question is, why does it have to say komum and also the Rish points out, why does it say kol mum, and also in the Pasuk, and it's actually written over here in the Ein Yaakov as well, it's written with a silent aleph. The word mum is usually mem vav mem, but here it's written with a silent aleph, mem aleph vav mem, which therefore can be darshaned also to be related to the word mu'uma, which means anything. So what does that mean? There wasn't even in them anything like a mark from bloodletting. So you have a person has to let blood, and back then that was a regular health treatment that they would do all the time. So a person would have a puncture mark in their skin from where blood had been let, and eventually it would scar over. They didn't even have that, implying that they never even needed bloodletting. Marshal brings from Marshal and from Reb Sadia Goyen that it doesn't even mean that. It just means in general, even something as minor as that, meaning, and there wasn't even any other kind of minor defect or blemish in them either. So that's Asher in Behem Komul. The sixth thing that Nebuchadnezzar wanted of his candidates is that they should have the strength to stand in the king's palace. So what does that mean? It doesn't take particular strength to stand there more than anything else. It means more than that. It does mean more than that. It means that they would force themselves to avoid laughing. There's Gemara elsewhere in Chagiga that has the expression, which is brought in many places in Chassidus, when a person acts in a jesting way, in a joking way, in front of the king, he could be chayiv misa for that. So you need people who are so in control of themselves and of their emotions that they can hold back from laughter, or min asicha, or from idle conversation, or min ashena, or from sleep, even if they're sleepy, but if the king calls for them, they're going to force themselves to stay awake, or ma'am mibna latzim, and b'shoshin, and tzirachim, and kveyim, and they'll hold themselves back, even if they have to go to the bathroom, or mifnei emas malchus, all because of awe and fear for the king. So this is asher koyach behem, that they have the self-control to be able to be like that, to be able to stand at attention, and not do any of these things.
So funny in the Hechal Melech.
There can be all kinds of funny things in the Hechal Melech. You could have that, sometimes they bring entertainers to entertain the king, like jesters or whatever. Sometimes you have somebody says something or somebody does something that looks funny or sounds funny or whatever. So that takes a lot of self-control then to hold oneself back. In a later period also, you have the famous story of Bustanai, who was supposedly the last descendant of Malchus Beis David in the times of the Persians. You have the famous story about him from Marcus Lehmann. The story goes back long before him. It's told in Seder Adertus. He wasn't actually really the last surviving member of Malchus Beis David. We have Reb Shuda going explicitly telling us otherwise. But anyway, you have the whole story of how he was the last of his immediate family at any rate, and then he's brought there and appointed as Reish Galus. And you have part of the story over there that's told. Is that one as he's standing over there at attention in front of the king, and a mosquito comes and starts biting him on the forehead, and he doesn't move a muscle to brush it away or whatever. And the king asks him, how you talking? I mean, how do you have? And he explains, because my father taught me. This is we learned Ben Achabe. He's descended from the Rosh Hagelus. He's descended from David, like Hanan and Mishael Azariah, that you have to stand at attention in front of the king, like we have in our Gemara over here. The upshot is that the king granted him, among other things, he made him Rosh Hagelus, and he also gave him a coat of arms where the centerpiece of it was a picture of a mosquito in recognition of that. Next. So the pasuk says that that Nebuchadnezzar told his chief of staff, this fellow Ashpenaz, to gather these guys. The name Ashpenaz, by the way, is a bit interesting in itself. There's a pirush attributed to the Psadia Goin on Sefer Daniel. He said he darshins a lot of the names over there in interesting ways. He says the name Ashpenaz stands for Ish Ponav Zoyafim, a man who has an angry looking face. So this is the chief of staff that Nebuchadnezzar ordered him to gather the boys for this. Anyway, so the pasuk says, "Vayhi b'hem b'nei Yehuda." Among them, from the descendants of Yehuda, were Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, Azariah. So does that mean all of them are from Bnei Yehuda? Amar Rabbi Elazar, "Kulan b'nei Yehuda heim." So Rabbi Elazar says, "Yes, all of them were from Bnei Yehuda," which fits with the drasha that we said before that there were six descendants of Rus and Boaz who had these six qualities, and then four of them are Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, Azariah. All four of them are in fact descended from the royal family. Reb Shmuel ben Achmeni, on the other hand, Reb Shmuel ben Achmeni says, no, Daniel ben Yehuda, Daniel alone was from the descendants of Yehuda, Hanani, Mishael Vazariah, Mishael Shvatim, and Hanani, Mishael Vazariah were from other Shvatim and not necessarily from Shevet Yehuda. Meaning, in other words, according to that way, you would say in the pasuk, Vayihi bohem ben Yehuda, Daniel. And then in addition, there were also Hanani, Mishael Vazariah, who were from other Shvatim. Which means Rashi says that Reb Shmuel ben Achmeni would disagree with the drasha before about the six barley grains and the six people. On the other hand, there's a medrash that gives a different list of six that takes out instead of Hanani, Mishael, Azariah. There's a different list that has Chizkiyahu and a couple of other people. So in that case, it could still work that he holds of that drasha. He just doesn't hold of the same list of people. Chizkiyo and Yoshio, okay. Ion Yaakov points out that there's a list in a medrash that lists Hanani, Mishael, Azariah as one, because we always find them together, and then you have Chizkiyo and Yoshio to fill out the number. Now, going back about a hundred years before their time, how did these tzaddikim come to be in Nebuchadnezzar's palace in the first place? So Chizkiyahu, who was, as we're saying, Daniel's ancestor, and maybe also Hanani, Mishael, Azariah's. So what happened was, in his times, we're going to learn as we go pretty soon in the Perek, we're going to start talking about the whole story with Chizkiyahu and Sennacherib, how Hashem destroyed Sennacherib's army, B'derech Nes. After that, the pasuk describes the king of Babel, Meroidach Baladon, heard about what happened and about the tremendous nest. We're going to have more about that story later on in the parak as well. He sent messengers to Chizkiyahu, and Chizkiyahu started showing them all his treasures, everything. He opened up all his treasures in the palace. He had his wife serving him at the table. Even Chazal tell us he opened up the Oren and showed them the Luchas. So now Yeshaya comes to him and says, who are these guys? Where do they come from? And Chizkiyo kind of plays dumb, and they're very, very important people. They came from Babel all the way from me, all the way to see me. And Yeshaya tells him a very sharp nevuah. He tells him, because you showed off all of this to them, and you acted almost like subservient to them, therefore eventually Babel is going to come and conquer Eretz Yisrael and take all these treasures to Babel. In fact, the Malbim says it's not just a punishment in Hashemayim. He points out as a practical matter, up until now, Babel had no idea of the riches of Eretz Yehuda. How would they know? They're far away. Now all of a sudden they see, hey, there's a lot of riches over here. That started planting an idea in their minds. You know what? One day when we have power, we should go and capture all that for ourselves. So now, and Yeshaya tells him, the Gemara quotes over here, the pasuk, "Umimonecha among your children, Asher Yetzu Mimcha, who are going to descend from you." Asher Toled, that you're going to give birth to, Yikochu, they will be taken, Vahayu Sarisim Behecham Melech Bavel, and they will be Sarisim in the palace of the king of Bavel. Now, the word Sarisim has a few different meanings. Many times in Tanakh, the word Sarisim just means high-ranking officials. But Maharsha points out, if that's all it is, then it wouldn't necessarily be such a poronus, it wouldn't necessarily be such a harsh nevuah that Yeshaya is telling Chizkiyo. Okay, it means that there's going to be a golos, but on the other hand, it means his children will be, his descendants will be high-ranking ministers, so the Gemara doesn't like that explanation. So the other meaning of Sarisim is people who were castrated. It was very common in those times for Goyisha kings to the people who are going to work in their palace, they would castrate them. They'd do an operation on them to prevent them from ever having children. This way, first of all, they can be completely devoted to the king's service. They don't have families of their own. This way, they're not going to get involved with the women in the palace, and a couple of different reasons why the goyim would do it. For us Jews, of course, it's aser. But the goyisha kings would do that. So that's one possibility of what we mean by the word sarisim over here. So that's the Gemara is going to discuss that. My sarisim, what do we mean when Yeshaya tells Yeshaya tells Chizkiyo 100 years earlier that descendants of yours are going to be sarisim, the Heichal Melech Babel, so Rab almost sarisim mamish. So Rab says it means actual sarisim, as in they castrated them. So that's the punishment that Chizkiyo is being told that this is going to happen to them, which would mean, Rashi points out then, we learned earlier, we had a couple of different opinions, what happened to Hanan, Mishael, Azariah after the whole thing with the fiery furnace, and we had one opinion that they moved to Eretz Yisrael and raised families over there. According to this, that they were Sarisim Mamish, then that wouldn't work. They wouldn't have been able to. So that's one possibility. Reb Chanina Omeshin is star salvers kachavim b'yemein. Reb Chanina says that Avodah Zarah was castrated in their time. In other words, in their time, everybody started realizing that Avodah Zarah is meaningless. So according to that, then it means it is a punishment after all. It means that they're going to end up in the palace of the king of Babel. So again, according to Rabbi Lazar, it would mean that Yeshaya is telling Chizkiyo about all four of them. According to Rabbi Shmuel ben Achmeni, that only Daniel is descended from Chizkiyo, then it means talking about only him. So Maharsha points again, it can't be that Sarisim just means high ranking ministers, then it wouldn't be such a poronus. So rather what it is, if you say Sarisim Mamish, then of course that's a terrible poronos, a terrible disaster that's going to happen to them. If you say Shinistar Sabaris Kuchav Miyameim, fine, but they're going to have to go through a tremendous Nisoyan in order to reach that point. They're going to have to be, the three of them are going to have to be thrown into the fire. Daniel is going to have to be thrown into the lion's den. So in other words, according to that, the poronos that he's telling Chizkiyo is not just that your children are going to be in Golos and they're going to be serving a foreign king, but that they're going to have to undergo tremendous Yisurim before there comes about this Nisar Sabat Azar B'Yemeim. The expression Nisar Sabat Azar, by the way, is kind of interesting in itself, almost as though Avodah Zarah is able to have children and now it's been castrated and can't anymore. So there's the idea. Ben Yehoyada, another Mephoshim, explain what it means is that, like this, if it hadn't been for these open nissim that happened with them, with the furnace and with the lions and all that, the fact is more people would continue worshipping Avodah Zarah, meaning it would, so to speak, the Avodah Zarah would have children. He'd have more and more statues being made of each kind of Avodah Zarah. Now that it's Nisarsa, now that the Goyim start realizing this whole thing is worthless and nonsense, then you have a lot fewer of them, or none of them, being produced, and therefore in that sense you can say the Avodah Zarah stopped having children. And stopped having like new statues of it being made. You find in Goyish world history around this period of Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, you start seeing that a number of older Avodah Zarah religions start giving way to something new. In Persia, you had the Zoroastrians came along. There was still Avodah Zarah, but like they believe in only two gods instead of the zillion they had before. In India, you have the Buddhists. There's also like less Avodah Zarah than it was before. So you start having like there really is the site of scarce Avodah Zarah. You start really having that people are starting to think, you know what, Avodah Zarah doesn't really count for much. So the Gemara says, "Bishleim lemanda amash nistar sabad es kachav miyameim." If you're telling us that Avodah Zarah was castrated and then stopped in their times, or not stopped, but at least weakened in their times, and that explains when Nebuchadnezzar sees them safe inside the fire, he says, when they came out, when they were brought out of the furnace, actually, the pasuk says, "V'chavola isai behind," there wasn't any injury in them. Well, therefore, they had never been injured in the first place. As we said before, they didn't even have a little scratch or a little puncture from bloodletting. And now also, after going through the fire, there was nothing wrong with them physically. But if you say, like Rav, that they were actual sarisim, what do you mean there's no injury in them? There's a huge injury in them. And the answer is fine. Chavola denura, he means there's no injury from the fire. It doesn't mean that there couldn't have been an injury to them from the castration from before. Okay, so the Gemara says, "V'aksiv reyach nur le'ados v'hoin." The pasuk continues. Not only was there no injury in them, but there was no smell of fire on them. Now, if you're going to say that it means that the pasuk is telling us that they were still physically intact, then fine. It means that now they came out of the fire still physically intact, and not even with a smell of fire on them. Not even a singed smell on them. But if you're going to tell me that all the pasuk wants to tell you is they weren't injured by the fire, why does it even need to mention anything about, doesn't need to even mention anything about the smell? And the answer is that's exactly what it means. They weren't injured by the fire, and they didn't get a smell in them and their clothing from the smoke. So fine, the pasuk is telling us that, like, loy zu af zu, not only were they not injured by the fire, not harmed by the fire, but even there was no smell. It doesn't tell us anything about what their physical bodies were like that before that, where the nistarsa would have been sometime before that. Okay, the Gemara says, "Bishleim lemandamash nistarsa, but it's called miyameim." Following the opinion that of Rabbi Chanina that was saying that Avodah Zarah was emasculated in their times, Hainu Dichtiv. Thus, we find a pasuk earlier. The Novi Yeshaya says, "Benevur koyam Hashem l'sarisim asher yishmur es shabbosoyisim." Again, so says Hashem to the sarisim who observe my Shabbos, and Hashem promises them great rewards. So, if you're going to say now, the Gemara is understanding that Nevor is addressed to Hanani, Mishael, Azariah. So if you're going to tell me that they're called Sarisim because they had the schus that in their time of a disorder started to become castrated and emasculated, then fine. That's why the Pasuk is using the word Sarisim on them. It's a compliment to them that in their times they had the schus because of their Mesiras Nefesh, that Avodah Zarah started getting weakened, and now Hashem is saying, in addition, you also observe my Shabbos, and you get special reward for that. But if you say like Rab, that they were actually castrated, why would the Pasuk be using a derogatory name like that for the Tzadikim? So doesn't that show that it must mean the other meaning? I mean, Gemara says, Hava ha hava bahu. According to Rab, you would have to say it was both. They were, in fact, castrated by Nebuchadnezzar's orders, but in addition, they also had this chus that because of them, Avodah Zarah got castrated and weakened. So it's both, in other words. Next, the Gemara says, "Bishleim lemanom sarisim mamish." Okay, following the opinion that they were literally sarisim, like Rab says, then Hainu Dostiv. That's why Hashem continues. What's the reward that you sarisim are going to have? Bevesi of chemosa yod v'shem in my house, the Beis Hamikdash, and in my walls, you will have a memorial and a name, toiv mi bonim u'bonis, better than sons and daughters. Well, they're not able to have sons and daughters. Hashem is promising them like this: your names might be eventually forgotten, and what you accomplished might be eventually forgotten. So Hashem is promising them, I'm not going to allow that to be forgotten. But if you say like Reb Chanina that it's a compliment to them that Avodah Zarah was emasculated in their times, my toiv mi bonim u'bonis. Why does Hashem have to promise them that they're going to have a name better than sons and daughters? They can have, they're capable of having children of their own, and we even have the opinion before that they did it. Now, you can't say, Rashi says that it means, we're going to say it means both, because then there's no machlokas between Rav and Rav Chanina. And we just said before that Rav and Rav Chanina are arguing. So fine, you could say that Rav agrees with Rav Chanina's point that it's also Shunistar Savar Azar B'Yemeim. But if you say that Rav Chanina also agrees with Rav's point that they themselves were also Sarisim, then there's no machlokas. And the answer is, Omer Nakmeitz, we brought him, Shoy Lev Kvaru Mesu. Fine, it means that Hashem is saying they already had children previously, and they died. So now now they don't have living children anymore, and Hashem promises them that you're going to have a name and a reputation that will never be forgotten. Why the expression Yod Vashem, Eitz Yosef points out, Yod is like when a person is alive, when a parent is alive, he can lean his arm on his children for support. And then shame is after he dies, that lo yimach ha-shmoy mi-Yisrael, that his name won't be erased. So here, they don't have children. So either, again, they're incapable of having children, or according to Rav Chanina, we would say that they are capable of having children, but they had children and they died. So therefore, Hashem is promising them that they're still going to have a name and a reputation, and they're still going to have what they would have had from children all the same. Ion Yaakov points out that if you say Shinistar Savar is Bechav Miyameim, now of Rezorah, we know you have to destroy, and you have the mitzvah in the Torah, the Bad Temes Shemom and Amokamahu, you're going to have to destroy their names, as the Gemara says. It means if you had a place that was named for Rezorah, you're supposed to give it a new derogatory name. So now, then, in reward for that because they caused with their Mesiras Nefesh, that Mistar Savar Rezorah, they began that process of destroying the name and memory of Avodah Zarah. Therefore, their schus for that is that they're going to have a name and a memory that will never be erased. As far as Nistar Sumamish, then again, Hashem is promising them that even though you don't have children to continue on your name, nevertheless, you won't be forgotten. Okay. My shame, Olam.
They not be forgotten.
Because they won't be forgotten. They're Mesiras Nefesh, and all their story is going to be recorded, and we'll have it for all time. Yeah.
Doesn't the
Goy
have to destroy himself?
What? Yeah, no, the Jews, no. For example, when the Jews conquered Eretz Yisrael, they had a mitzvah to destroy all the Avodah Zarah they found, yeah. Okay, the pasuk continues, My shame olam etin loy asher loy kodesh. The pasuk continues, I will give him an eternal name that will never be cut off. Now before, it's in the plural, lasarisim asher yishmeru as Shabbos Esai, etc. Vacharu v'asher chafatzi, etc. All of a sudden it switches to the singular, shame olam etin loy. So who's the loy, the singular? That means, Amar Rav Tanchum, Yorash Bakapara B'Tzipori. Bakapara gave a drosha in Tzipori. That means, Zes Sefer Daniel Shenikra Al Shmoy. This refers to Sefer Daniel, which was named after Daniel. Chanan and Mishael Azariah, as great as they were, they didn't have this chus to have a Sefer named after them. But Daniel did. And the point is, even though, as the Gemara is going to go on to point out, Daniel was not a Navi, per se, and usually you would think only a Navi gets to have his Sefer named after him, nevertheless he did. And that's his special schus. That's shame olam etzen loy. There's an interesting point on it that I think the Chidah makes, that the word shame is the same gematria as the word sefer. So shame olam etzen loy. He's given a shame by having a sefer that's named for him. Yeah. Okay. So now the Gemara turns to, here's another figure from those times who ought to have a sefer named after him, who was also, as Maharsha points out, was also one of the king's ministers, namely Nehemiah. As we know, Nehemiah was the king's cupbearer. So the Gemara says, Mechti, let's consider, Kol Mili de Ezra, everything in Sefer Ezra, not everything, but most of it, Nehemiah ben Chachalia Amrinu. It was actually Nehemiah ben Chachalia who said them and wrote them. So you have like the Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah, really, even though we have them printed nowadays as two separate Sfarim, really the one Sefer of Tanakh. When the Gemara gives the list in Baba Basra of Sfarim of Tanakh, then it lists Ezra and then Divrei Yomim. There's no Sefer Nehemiah. There's a number of places where Rashi and other Rishonim also they refer to a pasuk in Nehemiah and they refer to it as Ezra. Later on, the Goyim split it up into two. We'll talk about soon what the Chidah says of why that's Hashgacha Pratis that it happened that way. In any case, you have like this: the Sefer Ezra, the part that goes under the name Ezra, was written by Ezra. But then you have the part that's named after Nehemiah begins Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia, and that part is like 2/3 of the whole Sefer. So the majority of it was written by Nehemiah. So you should argue that Nehemiah ben Chachalia, my time, and the Sefer al Shmei. So why isn't the Sefer named after him? Why is the Sefer named after Ezra instead? And again, as Maharshal says, after all, Nehemiah is also a courtier of the king. So if Daniel gets to have a Sefer named after him, why not Nehemiah? And the reason, so the Gemara says, gives a couple of reasons. Because he wanted credit for the good things that he did. Shenemar, he says in his sefer, and he says a couple of times, Zochra li lekai l'toiva. Remember me, Hashem, for good. So like he wanted credit. He wanted Hashem to give him credit for the good things that he had accomplished. He accomplished tremendous good things, but still, it's like a shtickle geiger. It's like a shtickle, like Hashem, does Hashem owe you anything? So he lost that source. So the Gemara asks, David Nami Meima Omer Zachreini Hashem B'tzayin Amecha Pakdeini Mishua Secha. Didn't David express the same kind of request as well? Hashem, remember me in the favor of your people and then have mind of me when you save. So you see that David is asking for the same kind of thing as well. And the answer is David Rachmi Hu D'Kaboi. David is not asking Hashem just to remember him the Torah. He's asking for Rachmim, not because of his Maisim HaTovim, but just that Hashem should have Rachmanus and remember him, as opposed to Nehemiah is specifically mentioning his Maisim Tovim. And ultimately, as Moses, it's not like Hashem owes you for it. Ultimately, it's all based on Hashem's rachmim, and therefore he has no business asking for that. Another point as well, and Af Yosef points out, is that Nehemiah is using the Shem Elikim, which means he owes it, he's owed it, like Mitzad Adin, whereas David uses the Shem Havaya, Zochrein Hashem, Betzayin Amecha, that he's asking for it Mitzad Rachmim. So therefore, so David is fine, but the way Nehemiah did it, he shouldn't have done that. Then another explanation, Rabbi Yosef Omar, the reason Nehemiah lost the privilege of having the sefer named after him is because he spoke in a derogatory way about those who came before him. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, he describes over there there was a terrible economic situation that the Jews who had come to rebuild the second Beis Hamikdash were in, and he describes how because of that he gave them a break. He didn't demand from them the usual taxes that pay for his salary and expenses and everything. He paid for a lot out of pocket. And then he contrasts, he says, Va'pachas Rishonim Asher Lefanai Hichbidu Ala'om, the Uriu governors who were before me made it very heavy on them and hard on the people. Vayitchu Mehem Balechem Vayayin, they demanded from them the costs of bread and wine, achar kesef shkolim aboyim, plus they demanded from them a salary of 40 silver shekel, gam nareim sholter ala omegam, and also their young men, their attendants also dominated the people and forced them to pay, as opposed to Nehemiah says, I didn't do that. And even Va'afal Daniel should go to him, and it was steeper, and even he was speaking in badly like that against Daniel, because Daniel had been one of those Uriu governors, and when Nehemiah says in a general way, the governors who were before me, Then he's including Daniel in that as well. So you have the pasuk doesn't actually say in so many words that Daniel was ever a governor in Eretz Yisrael, but you do have at the beginning of Sefer Ezra it mentions a governor named Sheshbazzar. Now Poshut Pshat is that's another name for Zerubbabel, and a number of the Mefarshim explain it that way. But in fact there was Medrashim that identifies Zerubbabel in turn with Nehemiah, so then it would be the same person all along. But there's a Medrash that says it actually brings on the Pasuk that Sheshbatzar is actually a nickname for Daniel Sheshbatzar. He went through 6 troubles in his life, including the Churban and including the whole thing with Nebuchadnezzar's dreams and being thrown into the lion's den and so forth, and therefore he's called Sheshbatzar. So in that case, it comes out he was actually a governor sometime before Nehemiah, and when Nehemiah says in a general way the previous governors were made it hard for the people, then he's including Daniel in that as well, and he shouldn't have done that. With that said, though, the Chidah has an interesting point. The fact is, again, nowadays in all Tanakh, you'll find that Nehemiah is in fact printed as a sefer under his name. So this is a very interesting idea. He says that later on, Ezra and Nehemiah were actually nisgalgal in Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was actually a descendant of Ezra. There's even a Yerushalmi word of Joseph ben Hokina says on him, I recognize his eyes look like the eyes of his ancestor Ezra, which either it means Rabbi Joseph ben Hokinas lived a long time, which is how the Rambam learns it, or Yeshayim, then it just means like he had a picture of Ezra or whatever. Anyway, meanwhile, Nehemiah, and meanwhile, Rabbi Gamliel is descended from Malchus Beis David, like Nehemiah was. Maybe he was a descendant of Nehemiah, maybe not, but anyway, the point is, you have the whole story of the tremendous humiliation that Rabbi Gamliel went through, being deposed, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah being appointed instead. So the Chidah says, because of that, eventually what Nehemiah had done, the Dak was wrong over here, as we're saying in the Gemara, was eventually Niskaper, and therefore it was decided, Minashamayim, that eventually he can, in fact, have the sefer named after him. So fine, we're not going to take away from Ezra, but we'll allow his part of the sefer to be called by his name. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Hey Elul. The pasuk says for Olam Hashkiyim, the Hartzi and Lishpat has Har Esav, that the saviors will go up on Hartzi and to judge the mountain of Esav. So what does this mean? What's this judgment about? There's two parts of it. Two parts of this judgment that the Ummah Sa'olim are going to face. First of all, there's going to be refining out the good. Many of the nations are going to be transformed into good. You have the expression that Chazal say, Osid Chazir Litar, that the pig will eventually become kosher, and the pig is a symbol of Malchus Edom. Then on the other hand, you have the second part is going to be the Bittul, the parts of Esav that are ragomor, that are complete evil, those are going to be destroyed and then gone completely, as the pasuk says over there a few pasukim earlier, that says that the house of Yaakov will be a fire, and Yosef will be a flame, and Esav will be like straw, and v'lo yisodid, and there won't be any remnants left, there won't be any remnant of the evil of Esav. All that's going to be left is the part of him that's in Minas Varev. Okay, continuing with halachas of tefillin, we're starting Simon Chof Zayin. Which is about where you put on, where on the body you put on tefillin and how you put them on. So the tefillin shoyad, as we know, of course, goes on the left arm. Al yodcha, as the pasuk says, where the word yodcha is spelt yud dalad chof hey, and therefore it stands for yad keha, the weaker hand. So that's the left arm, which is weaker, which is weaker by most people. What a lefty does, we'll talk about later on. Basically, a lefty puts it on his right arm, and then you have all kinds of interesting complications if a person is ambidextrous or does some things with one hand and some with the other. We'll talk about those as we get to them. That's the shame.